Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've ever wondered what the ne'er-do-well kid in the neighborhood might be doing in 40 or 50 years, you could hope for the likes of Tony Fitzjohn. He got off to a rough and restless start as a teenager, but through a series of happenstance, I guess, wound up in his own fantasy, Africa, working with George Adamson of Born Free fame. Now, Tony is field director of the George Adamson Wildlife Preservation Trust, and he's worked with the government of Tanzania to rehabilitate Mkomazi National Park. In all, Tony has spent more than 40 years reintroducing lions, leopards, rhinos, and African hunting dogs to the wild. He was awarded the Order of the British Empire by the Queen and the Order of the Golden Ark by Prince Bernard of the Netherlands for his services to wildlife. And he's written a book, Born Wild, the extraordinary story of one man's passion for Africa. He's talking to us today from Toronto, where he's visiting. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Good morning, Anne. Thanks for having me.
You were first inspired to dream, this is almost iconic, after reading Tarzan of the Apes by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yeah, it was probably the most inaccurate and ridiculous book ever written about Africa, but that whole idea of going off and being able to communicate with the animals and swing through the trees and all that just caught me as a child, you know, growing up in North London, and I kept this little dream with me for years and years and years.
You know, the idea, he got a lot of it wrong. He'd never been there, right?
No, he'd never been there. He didn't know what he was talking about, and it was all very different, you know. But you know, the dream changed when I was a bit older. I went on an outward bound course in the Lake District in England, and the man who was my instructor had been a warden in the Serengeti for many years before independence in Tanzania. And then his stories completely inspired me. I mean, and that, you know, it was the sort of cleanup of the dream. And I said, right, I'm off. And he said, well, Tony, I'd love to help you, but you're 30 years too late. Luckily, I'd never listened to anybody in my life, so I went.
Before we move on, I thought that the idea, though, that Burroughs did deal with the issue of communicating with animals. Something to that. It wasn't, you know, yodeling in the middle of the jungle, but there was something about that.
Yeah, there was. There was. That's what I liked about it. You know, although I didn't really read all the descriptive pieces, and I didn't really want a monkey. But that whole thing of the man out there with the animals, able to understand them, I thought, what a wonderful thing. I mean, it was unreachable. But with my background, I had to have a dream like that. Otherwise, maybe I'd never have got out of it.
So when your outward bound counselor said that you were 30 years too late, it was 30 years too late for what?
To go to Africa, probably, you know, be probably meant as a white man after, you know, independence had come into these countries, and be able to run around free, and able to live a life of freedom, being able to speak to the animals and just behave like it was 50-100 years ago.
So when you wound up in Africa, you sort of came and went a few times. When you got there, it wasn't immediately what you imagined.
Well, I took the boat, mm-hmm. As one did in those days, to South Africa because I had an aunt there. And it was during the apartheid era, and I felt very uncomfortable. You know, this wasn't Tarzan country. This wasn't what I was looking for, but I'd run out of money. I had to earn money, so I became a truck driver and a bus driver and all sorts of other things. And then slowly I hitched my way north. The great thing about traveling by boat is you meet so many people. So I had people to stay with on the way in Rhodesia and Malawi and Mozambique. And I hitched my way up to Kenya to teach for the Outward Bound School on Mount Kilimanjaro. And as soon as I got to Kenya, it just hit me. I thought, this is the place. It was just, the people were great. The country was great. The whole atmosphere was great. Everybody was pretty integrated. And I just thought, this is where I'm going to find what I'm looking for.
You went on a safari.
I linked up with a guy I met who was a game warden at the time in the Northern Frontier District, which was closed because of Somali bandit activity. And I went on safari with him and government rangers into some of the much more remote parts of Kenya, which is desert, basically. And, you know, if I'd thought this was the place before that trip, after that trip, I just knew I couldn't be anywhere else.
My guest is Tony Fitzjohn. He's the author of Born Wild, The Extraordinary Story of One Man's Passion for Africa. Tony was the worked for many years with George Adamson, and he is the field director of the George Adamson Wildlife Preservation Trust. If you have a question or comment for Tony, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also reach us via Facebook at the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You wrote that, well, first of all, let's talk about how you met the lions in the first place. You met George. Before you met George, you met Joy Adamson.
Yeah, I've been working in Joy Adamson lived on the shores of Lake Naivasha, and I've been doing some pickup work on a house next door. And she would go and talk at this house to some of the clients and things, and I would be the guy that took the check around in the morning. And so I'd met Joy, but never had much contact with her. But towards the end of my rather colorful and checkered time in the early days in Kenya, I ended up as a surfer at the coast. Very indolent life, lying on the beach all day, looking at the waves, surfing. And I highly recommend it. And,
sounds great.
Yeah, and I sort of woke up one day and I thought, you know, wow, my dream is not working out. And all my friends back in England were checking out as lawyers and doctors and surgeons and captains of industry. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I wrote to Joy, but she really had nothing going. And a few months later, I was in Nairobi and drove up with a friend to Naivasha. And walked into her house and introduced myself. And she said, well, I've got nothing going, but I know my husband has because his previous assistant's just been killed by one of his lions. And the job is vacant. And I thought, well, that sounds like a job for me, you know. And I don't know what I thought, but there was no turning back. You know, the idea of the lions, the idea of this remote area, no contact for sometimes months at a time, really appealed to me. You know, it seemed like another stepping stone in my rather sort of wastrel type life, where I went everywhere sort of 3 months for kicks or something.
You know, I kept reading in the book, waiting for him to say, you're hired, and that really never happened.
Well, he couldn't. You know, he never had any money. Joy had kept all the money from the sales of the books and the movie and everything. She did quite a lot of good works with it too. But because George wouldn't stay with her, a bit like a prince consort following her around the world, mm-hmm. He was the authentic part of the equation. And he was just back in the bush helping as many lions as he could, trying to set up prides, putting prides back now, not just individual animals. You know, he did his greatest work after Elsa, but people tend to latch on to the one animal story more than the great stuff that went on afterwards. And he never had any money. We lived off his brother, who did all our roads in this sort of piece of virgin bush, just lived off George's old colonial pension. Every now and then a tiny trickle would come in from his book. I'm talking a couple hundred dollars a year. And then later on, George had a very, very small income from a part share in some documentaries that were made about his work after the movie Born Free when he was in Meru Park. But, you know, there was never very much. And it was what we were doing was so incredible, was so fantastic. I always felt if I took any money for it, I'd be doing the wrong thing. This wasn't why I was there. and either stupidly or strangely or whatever, to this day, I feel exactly the same way. I still don't take a salary.
George had, I was very interested in, and you wrote a little bit about his past and what drove him to want to save animals was his past. He killed animals for the army, the British Army.
Well, you know, long before that, he was one of the original game wardens in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And he would trek around this huge area, the size, I can't think of a comparative size. I mean, he was on foot, so it was like walking around America on foot.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell the tribesmen, it's not traditional hunting anymore, it's poaching. Lay off the big stuff, or next time I come, you know, you'll be arrested. Sure enough, next time he came was 2 years later, and he'd arrest a few people. And they go into a very, jail in those days was a bit like a holiday camp. They go to jail for a couple of months and then come out and be his first rangers.
Hmm.
And, you know, he got a handle on a massive area. There weren't a lot of people in those days. There were very, very few people in Kenya. But he had a wonderful time amongst the tribes. After he met Joy, she followed him around and painted the chiefs and all that wonderful, colorful stuff of years ago. And he had a wonderful career as a game warden. Born Free then came along, or Elsa came along first.
Mm-hmm.
And he took early retirement to be able to put Elsa back into the wild, and then latterly Elsa's cubs back into the Serengeti. And then he acted as the wildlife advisor on the movie Born Free and actually handled all the animals that the actors could both get close to and work with. And then after the movie, he thought, what do I do now? And he thought, well, I'm going to commit my life with whatever I've got into putting as many of these animals who behave so well towards humans back into the wild to live their own lives, to have that expression of life that we all look for. But, you know, the thing about the hunting was, during the war, because he was a game warden, he was asked by the colonial authorities to shoot food for the troops
mm-hmm.
that were based out there. And local farmers also took this as an excuse to eradicate the game from their lands, and the slaughter started, and it absolutely sickened George and really turned him off hunting. Forever after that.
We have to take a short break. My guest is Tony Fitzjohn. He's the author of the book Born Wild, The Extraordinary Story of One Man's Passion for Africa. If you have questions or comments, you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7. NPR News.
Protests and regime change in North Africa.
Citizens inspired by democracy demanding their basic social and political rights.
We've never known a different president. I was born to find him a president. I was hoping not to die and finding him still a president.
It's the greatest day of my life. I couldn't have imagined that I would live long enough to see Egypt emancipated.
The world is changing fast. NPR News is there.
On 89.7 NPR News.
And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. Rain off and on throughout the day today. With thunderstorms likely, some of those storms could be severe. A high of 67.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Tony Fitzjohn. He's the author of Born Wild, The Extraordinary Story of One Man's Passion for Africa. Tony worked with George Adamson for 17 years at his lion preserve in Kenya. If you have a question or comment for Tony, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tony, a lot of people are familiar with the Adamsons as depicted in the film Born Free. That wasn't exactly what their relationship was like, right?
No. I mean, I think we've got to start at the beginning. You know, George was in this very isolated town when he was a game warden in Isiolo in northern Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few other colonial officers there, the DO, and they had their standard British wives. And suddenly into George's life came this extraordinary, the highly talented Austrian woman with a very strong accent that could keep up with him on safari. And George is a very laid-back, quiet, solid guy, very much in tune with his surroundings. You know, not prone to much partying or anything like that. I think Joy just gave him a real charge. Now, and, you know, they cruised along quite happily for a few years, but eventually I think it must have got a bit much for him, and her behavior was a bit outrageous. And who am I to say that? And by the time Born Free was made, you know, they were more or less separated. I mean, George was too much of a gentleman to say that. And he was pretty old-fashioned, so he would say, oh, well, we were just doing our separate things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were more or less separated. She was impossible. You know, driven by, I don't know, a sense of wanting to be famous, or driven by, you know, I never understood why, you know, how she could get close to the animals. I don't think they were really very fond of her. And she was just too overly energetic and uptight, you know, for them to be able to relax and probably communicate with her. But, you know, that's my call on it. And maybe that's a bit unfair, or maybe I shouldn't be saying this. But they were very different people. But the combination in the early days, I think, certainly suited them both. That's quite a bad judgment on it, isn't it?
You know, you had not read the book or seen the movie.
No, it wasn't the sort of stuff I watched, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I wanted to watch Danger Man or Journey into Space or some, you know, something exciting.
Some guy thing.
Anything apart from this silly old stuff. And I actually read George's book when I was trying to sail with a friend in a little tiny gaff-rigged Arab dhow from Lamu in Kenya to the Seychelles. And I read his book about being a game warden, and I was just transported back another 100 years or so and just loved it. When I got to the bit about the lions in the end, I thought, well, the old geezer's gone soft in the head, you know. I mean, what's all this nonsense? And didn't really pay much attention to it until I actually got there, and it hit me straight in the face.
I have to say, you know, just on a joy scale, my favorite parts of the book were about the lions and getting to know the lions and having you write about them. I was wondering if you could read about them. It's the very at the very beginning of the book. You're a certain particular encounter. It's in chapter one, and it's entitled "End of the Line."
Yeah, happily. You know, I came from the end of the line, and I thought this was the end of the line. The funny thing about being chewed up by a lion is they don't bite chunks out of you; they suffocate you. All that firepower, and they use a pillow. I suppose I should be glad of it. 400 pounds, a full-grown lion pouncing on my back, had already knocked the breath out of me. And when he put my head in his mouth and started to squeeze, it wasn't long before I began to lose consciousness. Only when he clawed at my stomach did I wake up, and my will to live reassert itself. It was just like that moment when you've been tumbled by a big wave and lost your surfboard. Abruptly, the light pierces the swirling water, and realizing you want to live, you kick towards the surface. I pushed my fist above my head and into the lion's mouth, but I wasn't strong enough. He was going to kill me. I can remember, as I faded away, which one was it, a wild lion or one of ours? It was one of ours, Shimon, and it was another one of ours, Freddie, who saved me. I had raised Freddie from the time he was a cub, but unlike that big thug Shimon, whom we had never handled, he liked me. Freddie charged Shimon and distracted him just long enough for me to regain a bit of consciousness and get into the fetal position. Freddie went for Shimon at least four or five times as Shimon came back to grab some other part of me. Even then, the bigger lion got me around the neck and started to strangle me. I went through that Reader's Digest tunnel, my life ebbing away, the festering garbage dump at the camp gates, my last view of the world. I knew what was happening, and as I gave into the blackness, I was furious about that rubbish.
That rubbish.
Yeah, well, it's Terence's, George's brother's rubbish heap, and the last thing I saw before I died was his rubbish heap. Expletive deleted.
You deleted a few expletives in there.
Yeah, well, yes, you know the sensitivities towards the Midwest.
Why did you decide to start the story that way?
I don't know. I mean, for years people said to me, you know, when are you going to do your book? And I said, and I would reply very politely, you know, if anybody else suggests anything that might have to add to my workload, I'm going to have to kill them, you know. and I don't know. I obviously wandered around for years thinking, how am I going to do it? You know, I suppose I better do it. I've had this great life. But the time wasn't right. I live in a world where everyone goes out to Africa for 2 years, writes a book, becomes an instant hero, goes back an expert, and tells everyone what to do, and they can't fix the puncture. So I was always very aware of that, and I was always very aware that I had to have lived a fairly complete life, but, you know, more or less gone full circle, so I could look at it for what it really was, and try and get things in perspective. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to start a book, I might as well start with something dramatic. You know?
Was that the only time you were attacked?
That was the end. Yeah, Christian beat me up once, but only in play. But it gave me a bit of a fright. But it's the only time in all those years I've been attacked and been injured. You know?
And who saved you, of course?
George, of course. Young Freddie the Lion.
Besides Freddie, right?
Young Freddie the Lion kept going for this bigger guy to try and get him off me and had to give up. And George came out because the only member of staff we had in camp saw what was happening. And George thought, well, the guy's joking. Tony doesn't have a problem with the lions. And he came out with a stick. And as I was being dragged off between the front legs of this quite large lion, he was just going to drag me in the shade to finish off eating me because he'd already eaten my right shoulder and the right side of my neck. And as he was dragging me off, George came out yelling straight for him. And the lion got startled, dropped me, ran off, turned round, crouched low on the ground, flicking his tail, looking at George, and George didn't stop. He just went for this lion, and it was enough bluff and anger and everything to see the lion off. So George could try and get me back to camp, and as he turned around, I was standing up. I can remember vaguely standing up and putting my hand to my neck, and it disappeared inside my neck and then came out at the teeth mark at the back of my neck. And I said, oh my God, George, am I dying? And George said, well, I think you probably are, but we'll have a look at you first. Tough old boys, you know. But if he'd said, no, old chap, you're going to be perfectly all right, I think I might have keeled over on the spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned his brother Terence and his, you know, his trash heap there, but he was very different from George.
Yeah, he was much more excitable. I think George was more like his dad and Terence more like their mum, from what I can gather. And he was a good old boy, Terence. You know, he was a confirmed bachelor and into his trees and his bush and his road cutting. It was kind of, I mean, I look back on it now with a little bit of shame, but we never really got on very well because I guess in some way we were always competing for George's affection. But George didn't have outward shows of affection for human beings. He was completely into it. Maybe joy had knocked that out of him. But he, He only had feelings for his animals. So, you know, and it was kind of silly. But it was that oddball combination of three people that actually worked.
You said you mostly avoided him, but that you bitterly regretted that later in life.
Yeah, of course you do. You know, well, why couldn't I have been more mature then? Why couldn't I? But, you know, he was critical of what George did. He wouldn't join in.
He didn't care for the lions or anything like that.
No, he didn't do anything with the lions. He wouldn't go out at night when George had to face a couple of wild lions coming to beat up our slightly smaller lions that wouldn't have come into their holding compounds at night, and they'd be all fighting and growling, and George would totter off on his own. And then the second time I saw that, I said, right, I'm coming with you. I don't know what's going on, but you can't go out on your own like this. But he would have done, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I was a bit angry at Terence for that. But, you know, I was young. I was full of all that, you know, mid-20s, early 30s sort of energy and love and anger and all those powerful things that course through your system at that age.
There were a couple things you said about the lions that struck me. One was that being with them and living in Africa and working with George made you a better human being.
I don't doubt it. I think if there's anything nice or anything solid or admirable about what I do today, I think the animals and George have given it to me. I mean, I owe them everything. You know, not just because I said, look, I'm going to go and do this, and I did it. They've empowered me to save as much of Africa as I can and to save as many of them as I can, you know, because I'm in a position to do so. They've got teeth and claws. Other animals have got poisons and horns. But they have no voice in this rather troubled, paved, concrete world of ours. And if I can make even the slightest difference or, you know, represent their world to other people so they might live in a bit more peace, then I will do so. I mean, I owe them big time, and I always will.
Another point you made, you wrote that when you walked with the lions, because you took these daily walks with them, you noticed more. In one circumstance, you saved somebody, or the lions saved somebody's life by noticing them floating down the river. They had fallen out of their canoe or something?
Oh, right, yeah. A group of World Bank town boys and their wives had decided to canoe down the river, suddenly hit the coral rapids, and chickened out. They had to jump overboard, get out on the bank. The river was full of crocs. They had to smash themselves up on the rocks where the river narrows. And we were sitting, George and myself and Christian were sitting at the foot of the rapids as the sun was going down in the evening behind the dum palms and the Tana River poplars and the big acacia trees. It was a wonderful sight. And counting the crocodiles in the water, all the little eyes, all the noses above the surface. And Christian suddenly startled, looking at something, and we couldn't work out what it was. And eventually, after several minutes, we realized there was something floating down the river, and then we saw some people on the far bank. Anyway, we couldn't work out what was going on, so we went back to camp, got our little boat, went across the river, brought them back, and these people had heard about George, and they went up and said, you know, thank you very much, Mr. Adamson, for rescuing us. And George just looked at them and said, our lion saw you first. And Basil, one of the guys, wrote a book, and that's what he called it, Our Lion Saw You First. Great, huh?
Yeah, it is. Then the idea that when you walked with the lions, those daily walks, that you noticed things that you wouldn't have.
Well, you saw the whole bush through their eyes. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got chewed up, because, you know, their senses are so much greater than ours that, you know, in many ways we would tend to rely on them as a bit of an early warning system for us. But when I got chewed up, I was squatting on the ground with Freddie, this lion, this palomine.
Mm-hmm.
And Arusha had killed a guinea fowl. One of the females had killed a guinea fowl. and we were making a plan to get it off her so I could get them in for the night, so this wild pride didn't come back to beat them up. And you know, we were a bit switched off. So that was a lesson learned. But, you know, what they saw, what they heard, how they behaved, it was a huge privilege to be able to share that with them. And the young ones would be obviously more scared of things than the older ones. He kind of knew a bit of what was going on. So every time we had more lions, you know, we would change. I would change too, you know, to sort of share their lives with them and also see them through it. I can't say help them, but just see them through it. Like mm-hmm. the mothers, you give them food and protection until their own instincts and their own inherited knowledge come in, and they're capable of leading their own lives.
You know, in defense of Shimon, later on in the book, you mentioned that you think he was probably poisoned.
I mean, yeah, we weren't in a position in those days to fly in vets or have postmortems. The airstrip was 2 hours away, and we didn't have any money. But we were convinced it was a year that the Somalis had started coming in and killing all the rhino. I think it coincided with people in the Yemen getting jobs in the oil fields, and there was money there. And the most prestigious thing in the Yemen is a rhino horn, rhino-handled dagger. You know, he came back 36 hours later with my blood all over his muzzle and his chest and his paws. And if mm-hmm. there's one thing that cats do, it's clean themselves mm-hmm. immediately. So he and his eyes were kind of rolling. I was in hospital, and he went for the lions to kill them. And George drove a Land Rover between them and then eventually shot Shimon through the head. So he was very, very, you know, he was very disturbed. So, we're pretty convinced he was poisoned. I mean, I guess it could have been a brain tumor, but they don't tend to suffer from things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess we'll never really know, but you know, if you think about things long enough, the answers normally come.
There's usually an explanation. In other words, it wasn't totally random.
Right.
We're going to have to take another break, and then when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Tony Fitzjohn, author of Born Wild, The Extraordinary Story of One Man's Passion for Africa. If you want to join the conversation, you're welcome. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Dan Savage started the It Gets Better Project in response to reports about bullied gay teenagers committing suicide.
If there are 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds out there watching this video, what I'd love you to take away from it really is that it gets better.
On the next Fresh Air, Dan Savage and his partner Terry Miller join us.
Ing and Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. You can do that at WOSU.org/email.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Comprehensive Cancer Center and James Cancer Hospital, rated exceptional by the National Cancer Institute. More information at cancer.osu.edu.
60 degrees in downtown Columbus, rain off and on throughout the day today, and the possibility of a thunderstorm as well. Some of those storms could be severe, a high of 67 degrees. There's a chance of rain tonight and cold, a low of 29. A slight chance of rain mixing with snow for Thursday and a high of 39 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Tony Fitzjohn, We're talking about his book, Born Wild. It's a memoir. He's field director of the George Adamson Wildlife Preservation Trust. He's worked with the government of Tanzania on the rehabilitation of the Mkomazi National Park. Spent more than 40 years reintroducing lions, leopards, rhinos, and African hunting dogs to the wild. Tony was awarded the Order of the British Empire by the Queen and the Order of the Golden Ark by Prince Bernard of the Netherlands for his services to wildlife. If you have a question or comment for Tony, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned a little bit about the isolation, Tony. It's not so bad anymore. In the end, it wasn't so bad, but if maybe bad's the wrong word to use, it wasn't so extreme. But I was wondering, every so often you'd mention a girlfriend, and I wondered, how did you meet girls? Anyway, how did you meet anybody?
People would visit camp. I mean, how's, you know, I mean, people would visit camp, or I go to town every 6 months or so. And party like hell. I was a real old cowboy, you know, so you just lead this tough old life in the bush for months on end, and then you go to town and party, and then you sort of leave town with, you know, hanging onto your horse's tail as he drags you through the high street, you know, and you know, I love girls, you know, I think girls are terrific, you know, and so obviously, and I had a great need, and probably a greater need than most people, for female company, while I was around, but I wasn't capable of sustaining a relationship in those days, and I didn't want really to settle down. You know, I mean, I'd found what I wanted in life, and I always thought there was no place for a long-term relationship and human children and all that stuff, because it would dilute totally what I believed in and what I decided I was going to give my life to, for better or for worse, and. So that meant I don't want to say I was up for grabs quite often, but you know, I would sort of flit around a bit like a fickle honeybee.
Eventually, you did settle down, though.
Yeah, strange. You know how it happens, you know. And I don't want to sound corny. Sorry, guys, here I go. But, you know, when I met Lucy the second time, I opened the door and there she was, and I got hit by that thunderbolt thing. I just knew, you know, it was many years before we got together after that, but I just knew that this would be the girl I'd settle down with, but strange the way life goes.
How did marriage and then family of four children, how did that change life for you?
It made it even fuller. I mean, it was, I think men and women get together and have children, and you kind of know it's what you're meant to do. I mean, it's a very basic, primeval thing. But I think it made my life better. I mean, first of all, having kids takes away an enormous amount of self-obsession. And, you know, to have these little things that you've got to care for as well that are such a long-term project, you know, really brings out any sort of sense of commitment you've got and everything else. And the kids were great. And then suddenly, you know, I saw a brighter future. Maybe one day one or two of these kids of ours would pick up on what I was doing. Maybe they'd like to do it. And, you know, I was never, you know, even though they're going to lead their own lives and make their own choices. But it was wonderful. You know, Lucy was a great mum. Obviously, being in Africa, we had a bit of help, so it wasn't that excruciating. We live on the job, and, you know, around the camp in the middle of nowhere. I've had to create, you know, a house, power. We're our own electricians, plumbers, everything. Nothing is laid on, you know. And it just slotted in very naturally.
You were at first in the Coral Reserve with George. You mentioned the poachers and the corruption. Can you tell us a little bit about how things changed from back in the days when George would travel around and tell people, you better not poach or I'll arrest you? That was different than what occurred later on, 19 years later.
Well, you know, we did it. It's our fault. You know, the white man came to Africa and sold these big animals and, you know, came at a stage when he had guns already, and they shot everything. They shot elephant for billiard balls, piano keys, living room clutter. They shot at rhinos for the horn. Then the Far East, there was a big market in the Far East where it's used for all sorts of medicinal things. The Arab slavers before the Brits also did an enormous amount of shooting. And there was this legacy of just wipe out everything in front of you. It's the Wild West, just like the men driving their cattle through, which is what it's down to now, is the cattle herders that are wiping out everything in front of them, from wild animals to villages to complete tribes to whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the population increased. The colonial settlers came in, the missionaries came in, and the whole dynamic changed. It wasn't just this playground for the shooters anymore. People were settling, people were going to school, locals were going to school, people were learning about things. The population just doubled every 4 or 5 years. And so now you've got a situation where there's still money in rhino horn, a lot, more than ever. A good set of horns on the street now is worth $25,000. A few years ago, literally a few years ago, it was $500-$600 to the poacher. So looking after rhinos is quite a heavy-duty task these days.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many more people. Areas for wild animals have shrunk. There's still plenty of room. Us guys that have been spoiled by the past still feel like we're jumping between oases, but it's not like that. There's vast areas under wild animals. The pressure's on them and on these big areas, which are huge, great worlds without walls. Unlike southern Africa, South Africa, where everything is fenced, you know, Kenya's got one or two fences, but basically it's this huge world without walls. It's a wonderful place. And the authorities, you know, the same as anywhere else in the world. You know, some of them do a terrific job, some of them don't bother. But there are still a lot of animals. There are still vast areas that the governments are trying to protect under wildlife. But they're stretched. And on top of that, just to the north and the east, you've got a complete failed state of Somalia, which has turned its own country into a desert in living memory, not even written memory, because of overgrazing by domestic stock. They've had some bad luck with the weather. Stock has increased as the population's increased. But they've turned their own country into a desert, and they're in the traditional process of moving south. And it's a sad reflection on our times now that the Somali bandits that we faced for so many years, that are still around but not in the same numbers,
mm-hmm.
Coming to rape the natural resources of a neighboring country, have left us in peace for a bit because of so much money hijacking ships in the Red Sea. So our elephants and rhinos are being left alone a little bit. I'm not saying support the Somali pirates, but you know, that has had an effect on the positive effect on the bush in East Africa.
Both Joy and George were killed by poachers, right? But at different times.
Joy was murdered by a disgruntled ex-employee, kind of surprised nobody.
Yeah.
And George was gunned down at the age of 83, going to the rescue of someone he hardly knew. But he took on five men with AK-47s armed with a pistol. So I guess he was getting a bit shaky, he was getting a bit old, his sight was going again, and I guess, truth be told, he knew it was going to happen, he just so sickened by it all, he just took himself out. He went out like a charging lion, God bless him.
Chris from Worthington, you're on the air, welcome to the show.
Hi guys, what a great show.
Thank you.
I don't know much about lions, and I was calling just to understand more about them. For example, like, how is a fried lion, how is that different than the pack of wolves that we have here?
Well, if you tell me about a pack of wolves, I'd be able to compare them. I don't think there's very much difference. I mean, they're a social cohesive unit that hunt together and move together. Lion prides are a matriarchal unit. The male, who's got a much bigger territory to look after, won't hang around for long. He wants to make sure that the cubs are his, not some other lion's. Otherwise, he'll he will kill them, and the lioness will come into season, and they'll mate again. But it's a matriarchal society, like an elephant society. And the girls, you know, raise the young, hunt for them, and then when they're about 18 months or just under 2 years old, we'll tell them to go their own way, and they'll come into season again and start mating. And the males just move around in typical male fashion, making sure they're the boss.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. You wrote over and over again in your experiences over and over again, the Europeans and the white Kenyans supported you with words, but that the black Kenyans helped you with action.
Well, I mean, they had to, because that was slightly unfair on some of the white Kenyans. But no, I mean, because the Africans and the Kenyans had the government, and they were in a position to help. And the Europeans that were still working within a government system were probably a bit nervous about their own jobs, so weren't prepared to go out on the limb that I would expect to. Maybe that was a bit naive of me. Maybe that was a bit unfair of me, but that's just how I saw it, how I called it. But, you know, I was making the point that don't give Africa a bad rap. You know, it's a tremendous place. The people are absolutely wonderful. But like many other places in the world, they don't choose their leaders too well, and power does go to people's heads. But in my dealings with most of everybody that I've worked with there, they've been absolutely terrific and very supportive. And when there are baddies, you've got to overcome it, and they're quite tough. But that's what I try to put down in the book, and that's how I try to write the book, that all the goodies get a hug, and all the baddies get named and shamed, because that's the way it should be, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe it's not very politically correct, but then I never have been.
I was this morning when I finished reading the book, I was thinking, gosh, where's he calling from today? Because I can't imagine you out of Africa.
I have to travel every year to fundraise for what I do. The governments of both Tanzania and Kenya are terrific to me, because I'm back in Kora again now. Mm-hmm. Having brought Mukumazi to national park status
in Tanzania,
I do have to fundraise, and I do have to move around the world, and it's pretty hokey. It's through friends and friends of friends, certain institutions that have checked me out support me, U.S. Fish and Wildlife being one. So thank you for paying your taxes, and I'm enormously grateful to them. And you know, I'm sitting today in Toronto watching the snow coming down and this lovely blanket of white cover. And I was thinking, that's what you do to civilization. You cover it in snow. It looks so much better.
I agree.
And I've suddenly got into the 21st century. And I'm on Twitter now.
I never would have imagined that.
Well, you know, you've got to keep up.
Yeah.
my son said, he's 14 at school in England, said to me, what do you mean, Dad, you're not on Facebook and Twitter? That's kind of sad. So anyway, and I'm just beginning. If anyone wants to keep up with me, I'm Tony_FitzJohn on Twitter. So send me what have you meant to do on there?
People follow you on Twitter.
They friend you
on Facebook. They follow you.
I can't even get that right.
Well, you know, you do what you can. Yeah, it's okay. Hey, I just, I'm new at it. That's why I can remember it. You made the point about when you moved to Tanzania after George died so tragically. When you moved to Tanzania to take over the national park there, that you made the point that you were no longer anybody's assistant. Made me wonder, I mean, obviously, technically, literally, you were no longer George's assistant, but I was wondering what you learned as George's assistant that helped you make that transition.
It wasn't a national park. It was a chunk of wasteland.
Okay. You turned it, yeah.
The government was about to write off, probably de-gazette, and they didn't want to. And when I came along, It was extraordinary. They offered me the whole country. And maybe that was a bit of a misnomer. Yes, I was on my own. But in many ways, if I'm honest with myself, I'll always be George's assistant. You know, he changed me. He taught me, or he showed me a lot of what I know now. And there are still times, I'm not looking at anything fanciful here, but when I sort of sit and I can't make decisions or things won't come, you know, I still talk to George. I still sit there and think about him and wonder what he would have done. And it's always been very important to me in my life, dead or alive, that I never let George Adamson down. So I am never alone, which is a great feeling.
Do you still have lions?
No, for 7.5 years I did have a lioness in Mukamazi as I was building up the rhino sanctuary, which is Tanzania's only rhino sanctuary, and the African hunting dog project, both captive breeding, veterinary, and translocation and release. And the authorities were great. They let me have a lioness, take on a lioness, but they are a massive full-time job. I had two Tanzanians that helped me look after Chippy. In fact, four of them could actually handle her. And they were absolutely wonderful with her. And she became a massive icon for everything we were doing there. And but, you know, when I left Cora, I thought, I'll just go to southern Tanzania and do more lions and do more leopards, and this is what I'm good at, and this is what I love. And but I just sort of got to the stage in life where I realized I knew too much. And when the Tanzanians gave me that incredible opportunity of being able to work on the management side, mm-hmm. No one was being offered the job as Ranger Rick in those days, and work on the management side and work with them, you know, with all the good stuff and with all the bad stuff. I knew I had to take it, and I knew I had to concentrate on the two animals that needed the most help, which were the rhino and the African hunting dog. And, you know, quite a bit had been done about the rhinos in Kenya. Nothing had been done in Tanzania. And there was an enormous amount of talk and seminars and conferences, and don't get me off on that one, because I will rant and rave. Anyway, about the wild dogs, and no one was doing anything. Mm-hmm. And this is what I've come across so many times in Africa. We are top heavy with self-serving researchers, inverted commas, and seminars and conferences with some, you know, and we just want people to get out there and do it. You know, when you're working in a field like mine, it should be dirty, dangerous, and heartbreaking. And if it's not, you're not doing it properly. You know, we don't want a plethora of paperwork and trees cut down to produce rubbish.
Well, Tony Fitzjohn, I'm glad they cut down a tree for your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tony Fitzjohn. He is the author of a new book, Born Wild, The Extraordinary Story of One Man's Passion for Africa. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.